Good morning. I'm State Representative Dave Pinto. I'm the chair of the House Early Childhood Finance and Policy Committee, and I'm calling this meeting of the committee to order pursuant to House Rule 10.01, which allows for virtual hearings of this type. I want to make sure that members of the public who are watching this are aware that our committee materials, including the agenda and a large volume of materials, are posted to our committee website on the House website. And that with that, we will start with the taking of the roll. Ms. Chambers, if you can do that, please.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Present.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Bennett.
Present.
Representative Bolden.
Present.
Representative Daniels.
Present.
Representative Dabney. Representative Damon.
Present.
Representative Juergens.
Present.
Representative Cochise-Mitchell.
Present.
Representative Morrison.
Present.
Representative Wasluit.
Present.
And Representative Wolgamott.
Wolgamott, present.
We have a quorum.
Excellent. And we'll just deal with our minutes from February 18th. Representative Pryor, if you can make a motion to approve those minutes.
I so moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any additions or corrections, members? Not hearing any. All in favor of approval of the February 18th minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, the motion passes. We have our minutes approved for February 18th. And so, members, I am very excited today to have us be hearing House File 1200, which is the proposal for paid family medical leave. This has been a little bit of time in the making, and we're very excited to be the first committee in the Minnesota House to hear that, which is appropriate because we deal with the youngest Minnesotans and some who really benefit from this proposal. So I'm thrilled to have Chair Richardson with us today to present her bills. A reminder, members, that we heard about this proposal in general terms a couple weeks ago when we had some national expertise here in talking about paid leave, and I'm sure we'll get to that in a bit. And so first, Chair Richardson, we should have your bill moved. And so Representative Pryor, if you'd be willing to move for House File 1200 to be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Yes, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And so with that, Representative Richardson, welcome to the committee, and please begin presenting your bill. Then we'll move to testifiers, et cetera.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 1200 would create a paid family and medical leave insurance benefit program. The program is modeled after our state's unemployment insurance benefit program and would provide a much needed safety net for families in order to be able to take critical time for bonding with new children and to also allow families to be able to respond if they are faced with the illness of a little one. At some point, the majority of workers will need to take some time away from work to care for a new child, a sick family member, or to recover themselves. Caring for others and receiving care is a key component of being human and living a fulfilling life. And unfortunately, the reality for many Minnesotans is it's not that simple. In the midst of the COVID pandemic, it has become even more clear. Illness can strike at any time for workers without paid leave benefits, and individuals are too often left with the impossible choice between caring for a young child or keeping their job. While Congress addressed this temporarily with the emergency paid COVID leave, as a state, we still lack a permanent and comprehensive paid family and medical leave policy. For other states that have implemented policies, there have been clear benefits. I'll share some of these proven results that are related to the purview of the Early Childhood Education Committee. There's also strong bipartisan support for paid leave as well. Recent studies show approximately 79% of voters support permanent paid family and medical leave programs. Some research from other states that have established paid family medical leave programs have found that paid family leave provides time for families to create a strong bond with their children during those critical early months. It also increases rates and duration of breastfeeding, and with that increased rate and duration of breastfeeding, it reduces things like recurrent ear infections and reduces the rates of hearing problems associated with those types of infections. It increases the rates of on-time vaccinations, reduces infant hospital admissions, and fathers that take leave with new children contribute to greater involvement in caring for their children later in life as well. It's been associated with a reduction in postpartum depression. It has been known to address some of the disparities that we see, not only in maternal mortality and morbidity, but infant mortality and morbidity as well. And women who take paid leave are 93% more likely to be in the workforce 9 to 12 months after a child's birth than those without any leave. Working families with paid leave are also more economically secure and are significantly less likely to use public support programs in the year after their child's birth. Currently, across the state, leave programs are inconsistent and there are disparities in those who have access to leave and those who do not. We see disparities for BIPOC families and also low-wage workers. We need policies that promote time for parents and caregivers to care and bond with their infants and toddlers without jeopardizing the ability to meet their basic needs. In addition, families need the ability to care for sick children as well. For example, the pediatric cancer rate has been increasing over the last two decades. Almost half of all pediatric cancers occur during early childhood, with the peak incident rate of invasive childhood cancers occurring during infancy. Paid family and medical leave would help to alleviate the financial burden and eliminate the fear of retaliation when returning to work after caring for a chronically ill child. Today, I have a number of testifiers to speak on behalf of this bill, and Chair would request that you recognize Deborah Fitzpatrick to provide a brief overview of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Before I turn to Ms. Fitzpatrick, I just want to emphasize to testifiers and to members of the committee, and as Chair Richardson kind of referenced, our focus today is, of course, going to be on the early childhood aspects of the bill, those affecting the youngest Minnesotans and their families. There'll be other committees addressing other portions of it, but that's really our focus today, and there's certainly plenty of good stuff to talk about relating to that. So with that, Ms. Fitzpatrick, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Members of the committee, Chair Pinto, thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning. My name is Deborah Fitzpatrick, and I'm currently the Director of Policy and Legislative Affairs at the Children's Defense Fund Minnesota. But I'm here today sharing information from my prior role at the University of Minnesota Humphrey School, where I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's design and implementation study on paid family and medical leave. So Representative Richardson already talked quite a bit about this, so I'm just gonna skip on over to the next slide. I thought it might be helpful to ground the committee in how this program is structured. It's important to note that this is a contributory social insurance program model, and that is the dominant model in eight states across the country, as well as across the world. And I think that bears repeating, that Minnesota is really building on these experiences of many other states and the world that's had decades of time to perfect this way of approaching a benefit program. Now, just to drill down a little bit on what that means, being a social insurance program, it means that most employers and workers are contributing to a state fund based on their wages. It's around $3 each for an employer and an employee per week for a median worker earning around $52,000 a year, for example. Now, there are a couple of exceptions, and those include employers with comparable benefits can choose to provide their own program, and self-employed workers can choose to join the program. And then I just wanted to, as Representative Richardson mentioned, really lift up the fact that we are building on many unemployment insurance definitions and processes to reduce employer burdens, and again, to help us ensure a successful build out of a new state program. There are many benefits of a social insurance model. Among them, the benefit is portable, and that means it's not attached to a specific job or a specific employer. As we've already said, workers are receiving their income from the state fund during leave. COVID has shown us how very important it is to be able to access a benefit regardless of your employment situation. As do changes in our economy that result in an increasing number of workers with multiple employers, either at the same time or successively over the course of a year. This approach also keeps the costs low for everyone by spreading the risk and the costs across the whole population. It splits these costs evenly between workers and employers in House File 1200. It's also important to note that it levels the benefits playing field by geography and size. And this particular bill, House File 1200, doesn't have experience rating. That means employers that happen to have workers who have a greater need for leave are not penalized in any way, because they shouldn't be. It's also a really durable, popular, sustainable model. It has great political support, as has already been mentioned, but it's also durable and sustainable because it, again, is spreading these costs across the whole population, because everyone is contributing into the program and everyone can benefit from it. So I wanted to just briefly describe the benefit structure. Again, we can get into a lot more detail and questions after testifiers. But House File 1200 provides partial wage replacement during leave of at least 7 days. And I think that's important to note. This program is really designed to pick up where employer provided paid time off becomes insufficient. Provides up to 12 weeks per year for a worker's own serious health condition. That includes pregnancy, which is notable for this committee, and up to 12 weeks per year for care of a family member. And that part of the benefit includes a new child, foreign deployment, a violence situation, domestic violence or sexual violence, or a family member's serious health condition. And I also want to note that it's really important when we look at the way these programs operate in the other states. Again, great opportunities to learn from what's happening across the state and across the country and across the world. Data from these programs shows that workers most often use fewer weeks than the maximum allowed, and that the vast majority of workers use the program for only one leave over multiple years. I just lift up a few other elements. The maximum weekly benefit for the program is tied to the median, statewide median income. So that would be around 52,000 now in Minnesota, which is about $1,100 a week. Again, that's the maximum. Workers receive the partial wage replacement is based on it's a progressive wage replacement. So it kind of works like a progressive tax system, where the first part of everyone's wages is replaced at 90%. The next portion of wages is replaced at 66%. And then wages above the statewide median average are replaced at 55%. So that, again, helps us make sure that our lowest wage workers are able to take advantage of the program. So Representative Richardson already did quite a lot on this issue, and our testifiers are going to do more. So I will stop there. And if there are questions, we can get to those maybe after the testimony. Happy to answer many more detailed questions as members have them.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick, and members, as we've done in the past, I'm inclined to be open for any clarifying questions. Please raise your hands, but otherwise we will have time for more extensive Q&A and discussion after all the testifiers have gone. I'm going to turn to a series of testifiers now. I would ask folks, if you can keep yourselves to, I'd like to definitely say no more than 3 minutes. If it's possible to do even closer to the 2 minute range, that's great. But certainly no more than three, because we do have a lot of folks to fit in, and we'll have another bill at the end of this as well. And so first person that we have is Mr. Moore. So if you can identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed with your testimony. Welcome.
Yeah, how you all doing? My name is William Moore. I am a health educator, doula, and lactation educator for St. Paul Ramsey County Public Health. And, you know, I'm here in support of the paid family and medical leave simply because it's so very important for our new families, our new moms and dads here in the state and ultimately across the nation. As some may or may not know, our fathers take, you know, if they take, a medical leave at all, when they do take it, it happens to be during a shorter duration than our mothers. And one of the and one of the reasons for this is, you know, not just whether or not they're allowed to, but, you know, simply put, for economic reasons, it's very difficult to really sustain a two-income household this day and age, much less a one-person income household. We know that, you know, having our fathers more involved during the birth process and all together really helps to, mitigate any, you know, health and economic issues. But more importantly, anybody who's, you know, involved in early childhood development will tell you that the best chance that all of our children really have of hitting all their early childhood milestones is to have both parents actively involved in a co-parenting role. So, you know, that's regardless of whether they're, you know, directly in the home or not. And that, if I remember, you know, once upon a time, there was a big discussion about, you know, really closing the educational gap, you know, in this state when it comes to Black and brown children as well, Black and brown children and white children as well. And this is one way that we can indirectly affect that, you know, as well as reach and have a significant impact on those health disparities. With my direct experience, you know, as a doula and lactation educator, I've taken a very direct role in not only working with families to make sure that our fathers are, you know, are equipped and have the information to be actively involved in the lives of their children and our little ones, but also really taking a forefront role on really working with direct service providers, consulting and training home visiting nurses on how to better involve fathers during the birth process and on these home visiting cases so that we can have an impact on these health outcomes and all these early childhood development outcomes. I think having access to paid leave will further encourage, you know, our fathers to be able to do that with the comfort of knowing that they can both support them support their families, you know, all together, and also themselves if they happen to be in a co-parenting situation where they do not live in the house, and, you know, and take an active role in that development process. And I think that we need to do all that we can to do to really make that happen. For one, I'd really like to kind of thank, you know, Representative Richardson for supporting this bill. And I really hope that the rest of you kind of jump on board and support it as well.
Thank you very much, Mr. Moore. Thank you. And our next testifier is Barb Faber. And so if you can identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Bonjour, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Barb Faber, and I'm CEO of Indigenous Visioning. I'm an enrolled member of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe. I am here to ask your support of the paid and family and medical leave. I've dedicated my career to promoting collaboration with tribal communities, especially those that can improve the health and wellness of our children and families in Indian country. As you've heard, there are improved maternal and infant health outcomes when moms have access to paid leave. This is vitally important for Indigenous moms who experience longstanding maternal health disparities. We know culture plays a huge role in how women and families define health and how they interact with the health system. Having access to paid leave can help reduce the burdens and stress families experience when they engage with the healthcare system. Both from lived and shared experiences, I can tell you that the benefits outweigh the costs. It means a difference in rural Minnesota to rural families, and particularly those from communities of color and low-income families. It means the difference between keeping your minimum paying job or the ability to stay home with your newborn child or take care of an ailing parent. As a lifelong early childhood advocate that lives and works in Indian Country, I can't express what this would mean for families who already are struggling. Your young family should not be forced to choose between their health and financial stability. Please, I ask you to consider this and support paid family and medical leave, and which for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you so much to you, Ms. Faber, and for all of your work. Samira Bilal Robi is our next testifier. Please identify yourself and proceed. Just need to get you unmuted there. Whoops. Yeah, no, I do that many times myself. Let's get you going. There you go.
So sorry, I took up some minutes here. Good morning.
No problem.
Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Samira Bilal Robi. I'm the director of the Wilder African American Babies Coalition and Projects and program manager for the Integrated Care High Risk Pregnancy Initiative. On a personal level, I'm the mother of five, two of whom were members of the family I raised at birth, and a grandmother of 19. I've been involved in early childhood for 43 years. Wilder AABC works to meet the needs of all our families. In my testimony today on the family leave bill, I want to emphasize three things: the things a baby needs, support that parents need, and what the community results should be. Evidence-based child development tells us that infants need a safe, quiet, and supportive environment. The first 1,000 days of infants are essential to their brain development, and this cannot be fully reached when their immediate caregivers are not there to connect effectively. My focus before you today is on the African American and Indigenous communities who do not have work paid leave, work several jobs, and usually are in positions that are stressful and strenuous. It is therefore quite clear that they are not able to be fully engaged with their young. Evidence-based facts. The perfect milk for the baby is breast milk and an environment of singing, laughing, and reading. What is missing are parents not fully engaged in quality time to meet all those needs, returning back to work so soon, disrupting the natural pattern of parent-child bonding. The stress of poverty, which has the profound indication of disruptive brain development in infants and mental inhibition in worrying adults about finances and spending crucial time with their infants. In passing the parent leave bill, we can benefit as a community by paving the way for all families to be relieved of those social barriers and improving better development milestones for infant outcomes. In closing, I call on you to pass this bill so that our babies and parents can flourish, giving them more time to develop, to help in the developing brain they have been blessed with to nurture. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bilal Robi, and thank you as well for your championing through the years of our babies and our community and families too. So next is Linda Kopecky. If you can unmute yourself and identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Good morning. My notes up. My name is Linda Kopecky. I'm the interim executive director of the Minnesota Breastfeeding Coalition, and I live in St. Paul. Thank you for your time. I'm here to speak to the direct relationship between paid family medical leave and families being able to reach their breastfeeding goals. So many of you know, and the research has proved this over and over, that having access to breast milk as a first food and having that access for the first year or two of life provides many lifelong health protections. Breastfeeding also provides significant health protections for the person who is breastfeeding. However, many families, primarily Black and Brown families, are faced with a choice after giving birth: going back to work so the financial bottom doesn't fall out, or spending the time that is required to establish a good milk supply and set the stage to reach those breastfeeding goals of 6 months, 1 year, or even 2 years. So as a white woman, working with Black and Brown communities to make sure that there are resources and funding and experts for Black and Brown breastfeeding families, I am certainly not experiencing the struggle at a personal level. Rather, I am a witness to the struggle through our partners like the Indigenous Breastfeeding Coalition, the Hmong Breastfeeding Coalition, Birth Equity Community Council, and other boots on the ground supporting lactation in Black and Brown communities. The statistics are very clear. There are big differences in breastfeeding rates based on geography, race, and ethnicity. But one thing these groups have in common is that breastfeeding rates drop precipitously at the time members of these communities are returning to work. For many families with little or no access to paid leave, that return to work is as early as 2 weeks after giving birth, and that's hardly enough time to get breastfeeding established. Paid family medical leave is important. It removes that very real choice between providing a foundation for lifelong health and well-being and the family's own economic stability. It allows time for parents to establish routines to ensure that all families' members' needs are met. And most importantly, it speaks to the fact that Minnesotans ultimately really care about all families having every opportunity to lifelong good health. So I urge this body to pass HF 1200, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Kopecky. Our next testifier is Margaret Skogmo. If you can unmute yourself and then identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Margaret Skogmo, and I live in Detroit Lakes. I'm an early childhood educator at Laker Prep Preschool, and I'm also the mother to three young children under the age of five. Today, I want to share my personal story. When I entered motherhood for the first time, I expected some semblance of paid leave, and I was disappointed to learn that my job offered nothing. And with my first son, I unexpectedly needed a cesarean section to deliver him. My doctors advised that for 6 weeks, I should not be lifting anything heavier than the baby. I should be taking it easy for my surgical recovery, and that I should breastfeed on demand to establish my breast milk supply. Although recovery had some good days, there were many days where I was in great pain. And I needed extra time to rest and recover from such a major abdominal surgery. My husband received 6 weeks paid parental leave through his position as an ELCA pastor. And without his paid leave and support, I am not sure how I would have fared on my own. Over the years, the cost of raising our growing family has threatened our financial stability. We have worked really hard to save up money, especially when I took time off for the birth of our three children. And for a pastor and a preschool teacher who don't make a whole lot of money, keeping up with our medical bills, saving for retirement, our children's college funds, and our emergency fund, and just our future in general without paid family medical leave made us really financially insecure. If we are to be a culture that supports and celebrates families, which I hope that we are, we must pass the paid family and medical leave bill to ensure that families don't have to stress over wondering how they're going to financially support themselves and care for their newborn. Thank you for your time and for allowing me to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Skogmo. Thanks so much for sharing your experience. Next, we have the Reverend Corinne Friedman Ellis. If you can unmute yourself and then identify yourself for the record, and then please proceed.
Good morning, Chair Pinto and members of the committee. My name is Corinne Friedman Ellis, and I serve as a minister at McAllister Plymouth United Church in St. Paul, and I'm a clergy leader with Isaiah. I've been fighting for paid family and medical leave since early 2019, when I was the mom of a four-month-old daughter and just finding my footing coming back to work after a 12-week maternity leave. Even with that generous leave, with an amazing and supportive employer, and without a global pandemic raging, those early days were really hard. I pumped milk for my daughter in church youth rooms and Capitol bathroom stalls and my car. My husband and I dealt with the challenges of our child having a tiny, underdeveloped immune system and a rare allergic disorder that makes life pretty complicated. Through all of it, I was able to continue working full time because of an employer who saw me as a human being and afforded me the time I needed to heal, care for my child, and adjust to new parenthood. But others aren't so lucky. Members of my congregation have been laid off, forced to quit, or are foregoing a paycheck because of lost childcare due to the pandemic. Others return to work just a couple of weeks after giving birth or adopting a child. As a person of faith, I believe that whether we are white, black, or brown, whether we are a newcomer or we've been here for generations, no one should have to choose between family and work. No one should have to rely on the generosity and flexibility of our employers to be able to both work and care for our families. I urge you to pass paid family and medical leave this session. Thank you so much.
There we go. Thank you, Reverend Ellis, Friedman Ellis. Very much appreciate that. Next is Liz Harris. If you can unmute yourself and identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, Chair Pinto members. My name is Liz Harris. I'm a family child care provider in Cottage Grove and a member of Main Street Alliance. When I had my first child, I worked as a treasury analyst for a Fortune 100 company. I was provided with 12 weeks of paid maternity leave. I needed the time because I had C-sections for each of my three children. I only closed for 1 week after my second and third were born because I didn't want to make parents scramble for care or further disrupt the consistency that children need. I brought in another provider to substitute for me for the next 7 weeks. Both of these maternity leaves were unpaid. As a former treasury analyst, I am good with money, and while it was difficult, was able to budget for this time without pay, even with the slim profit margins involved in family childcare. But of course, you can only plan for the things you can foresee. On March 3rd, 2015, my sister-in-law, Holly Hogan Klein, was on Interstate 94 traveling to work when a semi slammed into her, causing a 9-car pileup, killing her on impact. She was 44 years old, and she was the owner of Hogan Bus Company. She left behind my brother and their three young children. I had just fed my daycare kids lunch that day, and I was 7 months pregnant when I received the call. I became more than an aunt that day to my niece and nephews, as I became their main caretaker. I again took some unpaid time, adding stress and financial disruption to an already tragic situation. If Minnesota had a paid family medical leave program like the one in this bill, it would make a huge difference for family child care providers, helping us manage planned and unplanned events and providing a level of financial security. It would help address racial and economic disparities that would make situations like the ones I've faced even more challenging. It would make the field of family child care more attractive to those considering it and to current providers like me. As the pandemic has highlighted, our economy cannot run without child care. This is the least the state should do to help family child care providers stay in business and grow the field. Please support House File 1200. Thank you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Harris. We appreciate that. Next, calling on Jessica Peterson-White, if you can unmute yourself and identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Jessica Peterson-White. I own Content Bookstore, and I serve on the Northfield City Council, and I'm also a member of Main Street Alliance. When my son Thorsten was born in 2016, I budgeted to have about a month at home with him, and then I eased back into work at the bookstore. It was too expensive to cover all of my hours, so I spent many days and nights with a baby and a laptop in my arms or with a little guy napping behind the counter at the store. Lyra was born early last March, and while I'd planned carefully so that I could be home with her for 10 weeks, it didn't work out that way. Because of the pandemic, my maternity leave lasted a little more than a week, and then I was working harder than ever before to make sure my bookstore survived 2020. Self-employment has given me flexibility, but I've made painful trade-offs between investing in my business and caring for my babies. In 2018, the City of Northfield passed a 6-week paid leave policy for our employees. We heard many stories of similarly terrible choices our city employees were facing, and all of these stories represent costs, often in replacing staff, but also in morale when people are forced to choose between what's best for their families and their jobs. We're proud of our policy at the City of Northfield, but it's not enough, and unpredictability is our biggest constraint. It's hard to budget because our pool is small. It just makes sense to ask employers and employees to contribute to a statewide fund, which would benefit everyone when they need it and protect us all from big variations in costs. Statewide paid leave insurance would also mean that Content and the City of Northfield could compete with larger employers by offering comparable benefits. And it would ensure that when one of my 12 employees has a new child or an illness, they could care for their families and return ready to work while my business had the resources to cover their responsibilities. It would make my business stronger and more resilient. I don't think anyone believes that babies should go to daycare 2 or 6 weeks after they're born, or that it's humane to force a new mom back to work at that point either. But if we're not providing a system that keeps family income steady during those precious early months, we're pretending that that is realistic. Or we're pretending that working parents can afford to skip a few paychecks. Every city employee, every content bookstore employee has a family counting on them to be both caregivers and breadwinners. Nobody should have to choose between the well-being of their child and their job. Please support a paid family leave system to ensure that all families get a healthy and secure start. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Councilmember Peterson-White. We appreciate that. Next, Dr. Hannah Lixton. I hope I'm saying your name correctly. I may not be, but if you can please unmute yourself and then identify yourself and proceed. See if we have you here. There we go.
Yeah, is my video coming through? It looks like it's not.
Your video is not coming through. So we can try to fix that, but we can hear you. And so that may be what we need to go with.
Yeah, that's fine. I'll just speak to yesterday. Here,
okay.
Pull up my words. Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Good morning. My name is Dr. Hannah Lixon, and on behalf of nearly 1,000 pediatricians in Minnesota, I am here today representing the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, where I serve as a board member and also as the co-chair of our policy committee. I'm here to discuss with you the importance of paid family and medical leave for the health and well-being of Minnesota children and families. We have a crisis of infant mortality in Minnesota. Babies born into Black and Indigenous families are more than 2 times as likely to die in their first year of life compared with white infants. Disparities like this result from systemic neglect of these communities from a system rooted in white supremacy. In this case, we actually have a solution. We know that giving parents access to paid family and medical leave reduces infant mortality and improves the health of new parents. But because of the same systemic racism that puts them at higher risk of illness, families in these communities are also less likely to have access to paid family and medical leave through their employers. We can save the lives of our most vulnerable young children by giving all Minnesotans access to paid family and medical leave. Parental leave, as you've heard, is associated with increased rates of breastfeeding, going to well child checks, getting vaccinations, and having timely visits when an infant becomes sick. Newborns do not have adequate protection because they don't yet have a strong immune system, and so they need immediate evaluation anytime they have a fever, for example. But if parents are back at work and don't have access to paid leave, their children are less likely to get this life-saving care. These are only some of the reasons that paid parental leave is known to reduce rates of infant mortality. As a result, the lack of guaranteed paid parental leave harms the children of our state. As pediatricians, our calling is to protect and advance the health of all children. Our children cannot speak to you directly, and so I'm here on their behalf. We need to come together as a state to ensure that every child has a chance to live, be healthy, and thrive. We can't solve this problem in our exam rooms, but you can save lives here at the Capitol. And that's why I'm here today to ask you to vote in support of HF 1200. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Lixon. And our final testifier is a second physician, Dr. Gerberts O'Brien. And so if you could please unmute yourself and then identify yourself and proceed.
Hello, Chairman Pinto and committee members. My name is Dr. Jana Gerberts O'Brien. I'm a pediatrician with expertise in adolescent health. I'm also a mother. I live and provide medical care in Minneapolis in primary care and also provide shelter-based health care for youth and young families experiencing homelessness. I'm a member of Minnesota Doctors for Health Equity, and that's who I'm here today representing. Today, I stand here before you to underscore the importance of paid family and medical leave for the health of all children and families in Minnesota. By ensuring economic security to families during critical moments such as pregnancy and illness, we create spaces for children and families to recover, to heal, and to forge lifelong bonds. When I had my own daughter as a medical resident, I was lucky to have 8 weeks of paid parental leave before returning to work overnights and weekends once more. Though the weeks were an all too short blur of breastfeeding, diapers, tears, it was an immense privilege to be able to take time to heal, to bond with my daughter, and to adjust to life as a new parent without fear that we might not be able to make ends meet financially. These early moments were critical for my own health and for my child's health and development. Now, let me contrast this with a lovely young family I met in clinic recently. This young mother works 2 jobs to support herself and her family. neither of her jobs offers any paid family or medical leave. When she had her baby, unlike me, she was forced to make a very tough decision. Spend the time she needs to care for herself and her child after giving birth, or go back to work so that her family has enough food to eat and can make the rent payments. She's left with no choice at all. When parents are forced to make these types of decisions, it has major repercussions for children and families. Without paid leave, parents are less likely to be able to attend recommended postpartum and well child visits for themselves and their babies. They are less likely to continue breastfeeding, as we've heard, and are at increased risk for postpartum depression. And especially important for this committee focused on the health and development of our youngest Minnesotans, when parents need to head back to work too early, children miss out on this key period of bonding and development with lasting implications. And this burden, as we heard from Dr. Lixon, disproportionately falls on people of color, who, due to a long history of entrenched inequities, are less likely to have access to jobs that offer paid family leave and are less likely to have an economic buffer to allow weeks without pay, further perpetuating longstanding disparities. So paid family medical leave lowers rates of low birth weight in preterm infants, reduces disparities, and can have a major impact for young children up until kindergarten. We've seen these benefits. Perhaps this is why almost every other high-income country in the world has paid family leave. At a time in our history when more people than ever are struggling financially, passing paid family medical leave is an investment in a lifetime of health for Minnesota children and families and will help dismantle significant structural inequities. I urge you to pass House File 1200. I thank you to this committee for, allowing me the time to speak, and thanks for Representative Richardson for her ceaseless advocacy for children and families in Minnesota.
Thank you so much, Dr. Gwartz O'Brien. And members, we're going to be turning to questions and discussion in just a second, so please cue those up. You can hit the raise hand feature if that works for you. Just as we do, I just want to give a big thank you to the testifiers. One thing I'll note is that you were all under the 3-minute mark, in some cases quite a bit under, so we appreciate that. More importantly, thank you for the powerful testimony. And I really noted that it was focused very much on the impact to young kids and families, which is terrific. And then third, and perhaps most important, as I'm stepping back and looking at this list of every one of our testifiers works in service to families and to our communities, every single one of them in really powerful ways. And I called out a couple of the individuals I've had a chance to work with through the years, Barb Faber and Samira Bilal Robi, but really every one of these testifiers. And so thank you so much to all of you. So we're going to turn to questions. I saw Representative Katiza Witun's hand go up first, and so we'll call on her and then proceed from there. Representative Katiza Witun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Richardson, for bringing forward this bill this session. I am so proud to be a co-author of this program. As you know, I had a baby during the interim, and my three older children are adopted out of the foster care system. So I have taken FMLA leave previously in the past when I welcomed my foster children into our home prior to adoption. And I think that speaking specifically to foster care, I think that this opportunity for foster parents to be able to stay home and still receive some income while they're bonding with new children that they're welcoming into their family could make a huge difference in the number of parents who choose to participate as foster parents in the state of Minnesota. We know that we have a drastic shortage of available placements and families willing to welcome foster children who are in out-of-home placement right now. And I think that this program, it would certainly contribute to people, more people considering becoming a foster home across the state. And then just speaking from personal experience, having my pandemic experience be mostly prenatal and then postpartum, I think that so many of the mothers who I have spoken with who also delivered a child during COVID so far this year, I mean, have had really mixed feelings. You know, they were either out of work because of COVID, or they were trying to step away to care for their child. And it just everything was so up in the air. And who knows if they would have had another family member who contracted COVID throughout this time period. And I think that this is one of the small things that we can do to allow workers to contribute to this program and then take the time that they need to either care for themselves when they need it, a loved one, or to bond with a new child, either a newborn or a foster or adopted child. And I think that it's just going to make families stronger. It's going to help our children start off on the right foot. And overall, I'm just really make a big benefit to the state as a whole. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Katiza Witun. Thank you. We'll turn to Chair Dabney. You can go next.
Thank you very much, Chair. My question is for Ms. Fitzpatrick, Dr. Fitzpatrick. And I'm interested in the portion of the bill that allows gig workers, self-employed, to buy in. I'm concerned more broadly about the transition of working America to independent contractors, gig workers, folks who lack many of the social insurance access to many of the social insurance programs that we have, but need them just the same as somebody with a straight job receives. Can you help me understand how this bill responds to the needs of those families?
Mrs. Patrick.
Chair Pinto, Representative Dabney, the bill does allow those gig workers, contract workers, to opt into the program, and then they would be paying into the contributions, making the contributions into the program. They would be making a two-year commitment to stay in the program for that length of time, unless they're, they leave that type of situation. It also allows business owners to opt into the program. So I think that's also a really important benefit. We know that a lot of times small business owners themselves really struggle when they need, like Jessica mentioned, as an owner of a bookstore. So I think those two important types of workers are pieces of our economy, right, increasingly. And then I think also there's a lot of people who work in a situation where they have an employer, but also do gig work. And the way that a portable benefit is structured, as I mentioned in my remarks about the structure of the program, that type of worker could opt in for their self-employment time and then be whole and receive the benefit both for their earnings from their self-employment as well as their earnings from their employer.
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Fitzpatrick, thank you for walking us through that. I appreciate that the bill is keeping up with families and work and the economy of today. You make a very good point about folks who may be working part-time or full-time in a straight job and then have, you know, what might be affectionately referred to as a straight or a side hustle, but it actually helps pay the bills. I don't know what other members' experience was, but at the beginning of the pandemic, when we were all working madly to try to make sure that our constituents had access to, for instance, unemployment, I ran into a number of constituents who said, well, I did this, but I also did this side thing, you know, that I was hoping to grow into a business, and now what do I do? So the bill seems to be keeping up with where the economy is, and I appreciate that. Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. And actually, before I turn to the next questioner, I might just build on that, Ms. Fitzpatrick, just to ask, perhaps this is the bill's author, but I would think that the workers who are in those sorts of gig occupations or in a series of part-time jobs, et cetera, are going to be more financially unstable, less likely to be receiving benefit and support. Regardless. So those are the people who especially want to make sure that we're helping. Is that, and for all the benefits we've talked about, is that correct? Chair Richardson, please.
Yes, that is absolutely correct, Chair Pinto. We know that access to leave is inconsistent across the state, and so really being able to help support those individuals who are falling through the cracks, that would include those gig workers for sure, and a large proportion of our lowest income workers within the state as well.
I would say the ones we would be need to be most concerned about. Ms. Fitzpatrick, were you going to add something on that as well?
No, I would just say to the point we talked earlier about how this program is really attempting to build on our learnings from unemployment insurance. And during the pandemic, we did, the federal government did offer that opportunity for these types of workers to receive unemployment insurance. So we have, again, some great learnings there around how to provide this kind of benefit. And again, it's consistent with this movement towards creating that safety net for those workers that are increasingly contractors.
Thank you. Representative Pryor.
Yes, I made it. Well, and I do have to echo the thanks to all of the testifiers here today. And you, so compelling and so rich in the stories that you're telling us and how we really can connect up what we've already heard as a committee in terms of just the importance to those newborns, to those infants in those first weeks that the 4 weeks would cover, the 12 weeks would cover. All the, you know, I'm picturing those graphs that we had about those infant brains starting to be formed and thinking of that ability for a parent to be there in a safe and secure situation where they can be responsible for that nurturing. And I do think back to the birth of my first child, which is this week, 40 years ago. And those are the things you never forget. And I was, as one of our testifiers said, I was the caregiver and the breadwinner for the family. And my employer at that time, I got 10 weeks. And what after 10 weeks, you got your job back. You didn't get any pay during that 10 weeks, but you got your job back. And that was a major step forward at that time, 40 years ago. And what I understand from listening to this is for so many, especially those in low-income jobs, those in our communities that have been most oppressed, that really hasn't changed. Even getting your job back may be an issue. And this is from 40 years. What I want to do is maybe go back a little bit and unpack what that means to go back to work after 2 weeks. And how is that happening in Minnesota, that a woman can give birth and feel like she has to go back to work after 2 weeks? And I think it was Linda Kopecky that brought up that 2 week statistics, but I would guess that others of our testifiers can talk about that too. So that is my question, is just to go back and understand what's happening in Minnesota, that 2 weeks after giving birth, somebody's trying to go back to their job.
Let's see who would be the right person to answer that. Was there somebody you had in mind, Representative Pryor, or perhaps I missed it?
Well, it was Ms. Kopecky that I think
Ms. Kopecky. My apologies. Yeah, my apologies. Ms. Kopecky, please.
Well, I don't have the statistics on the number of employees that have to go back to work at 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks. I don't have those at the tip of my fingers, unfortunately. I can speak to the breastfeeding rates and also what our partners here, for example, members of the Hmong Breastfeeding Coalition, many of them are with peer counselors with Hmong families. And many, many of those parents are going back to their work at, you know, medical tech companies at 2 weeks, because that's all the leave they get. That's all the leave their family can afford. And frankly, from our conversations with Hmong families, they don't want to be a burden on the safety net system. So they want to be productive. But that means going back to work very early. So for many workers, really, all the leave that they can have is maybe 2 weeks. Maybe they use some of their medical leave or their vacation during pregnancy if they had some challenges. So that's all they have.
Okay. Representative Pryor. Okay. Representative Bolden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't have so much of a question as more of just a comment. And I, too, would like to thank Representative Richardson for bringing this bill forward and for championing this. I, too, am proud to be a co-author of this bill because it is just so important. I also would like to thank all the testifiers today for your really powerful and moving testimony and for sharing your stories with us. Also, just I'm reflecting on, as Representative Pryor mentioned, you know, for the last several weeks, we as a committee have been hearing, you know, just how important those first moments and weeks and years with our smallest Minnesotans are for brain development, and how investments in that time has ripple effects and, you know, downstream effects.
And so, you know, just reflecting on how this is so important to affect that time. Also, it strikes me, you know, in a time when many of us individually and certainly as a state, we are thinking about how we can take steps to improve and rectify the many racial inequalities we have in our states and in our society, that this is an actionable and tangible step to do just that. As we have heard, you know, through the testimony and stories today, that this is in many ways an equity issue, that there are folks in Minnesota that already have this benefit and are taking advantage of it. And there are many folks who just don't. And there are certainly racial disparities within that context. And so I appreciate the, you know, the work that you are doing, Representative Richardson, to move this forward, and just cannot overstate how important this is. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Baldwin. Representative Juergens.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this bill is intended to make several different stops in several different committees. And as you said at the outset, Mr. Chair, that the role of this committee is to take a look at the early learning, the early, you know, the youngest ages of the children. So my question, one of the discussions that we've had in this committee has been on the cost of childcare and the wages that childcare workers receive. So my question is, how does this bill, if it does, how does it address that? Does this help the child care workers receive more income? Does it help decrease the cost of child care or increase the cost of child care? How does this bill impact those two things, please?
And I know we've got at least two testifiers who work in that sector, but I'll kind of look to Representative Richardson or to decide how to who you wanted, unless you have a specific person in mind, Representative Juergens. But otherwise, Representative Richardson, I guess we'll start with you and then go from there. So Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. You know, I think one of the really important things is it's a timing issue that we are talking about, as well as it relates to kids going into childcare. So I think that it's a complex issue that we could look at from a couple of different perspectives. But being able to have families have that initial time for the bonding and to be able to have more time to help support that healthy brain development and ensure that breastfeeding and all of those things are happening. If you have the ability to have the funds to do that, it's going to delay the time period in which kids would be entering they would be entering childcare. So there would be some benefits there for families for sure. And I will I'll defer to any of the other folks who work within the childcare field if they would want to speak about this from their perspectives. And I would also just add, I know that there's some work that's happening in other committees and other bills to really look at ways that we can really support the development of new child care providers and to be able to create ways that child care is going to be sustainable. Because as one testifier said as well, what the COVID pandemic really highlighted for us is that without a child care system, everything collapses within our economy.
You are preaching to the choir on that one, I think, on this committee, Representative Richardson, on that last point, which is a good thing. I just want to note for everybody that I'm hoping that we can wrap things up in the next 10 minutes or so. So I'm just going to ask folks to keep, we've got a couple more folks with questions. So just keep things tight. But I saw Ms. Harris, who works in family child care, and perhaps you can provide a brief answer to Representative Juergens' question.
Hi, thank you, Representative Juergens. And so, right now, there's absolutely no benefits that are given to a childcare provider. We own our own business. And the way that I look at this, when I looked at the financials behind this bill, there would be a cost to providers, but not at the level, it would be at a level that we could afford it. And we wouldn't have to increase so much the rates on parents versus if we were to try to go to the private sector to try to find paid family leave. So
when I look at this, it is a cost savings with a benefit. And currently there's no benefit in childcare. And when it's an industry that's essential to the economy, there has to be something for providers, because right now, as you know, we are in a childcare crisis, and it's only going to get worse if there isn't any kind of incentive. And I say incentive in that it really is not that much money if we can get this passed. So I hope that that answers some of the questions surrounding that, because we don't want to increase on parents because they already pay a lot in childcare.
Right, now that's my point. Is
Representative Juergens, please.
Yeah, just, and that was my point, is we've talked about that in this committee before, about the high cost of childcare and the low wages that the, I'm thinking more, Ms. Harris, is in the daycare centers. But, you know, you might have the same situation if you're hiring people to work in your in-home daycare as well. And in order to increase the wages that daycare workers are able to make, generally is going to increase the cost of childcare to the parents. And that's what we're trying to avoid. We're trying to make it more affordable on the parents and the families, but also a greater wage on the part of the childcare workers. And so my question was, how does this bill address that? And, you know, if this program increases the cost to the employers, then that's not going to help increase the wages of the employees, and it potentially is going to increase the cost to the parents. So I guess that's what I was getting at with my question.
I think Ms. Fitzpatrick is eager to jump in, but I'll ask you to keep it real quick if you can, Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just really important to acknowledge that employers are paying costs now. It's just that it comes in unexpected ways, in waves, to Ms. Harris's earlier comments. Child care providers are having to replace people who quit because they need to take a leave. They're experiencing costs, and all employers are experiencing costs because people take leaves and need to take leaves. And so this program really just kind of makes the spreads those risks across the whole population, makes the costs more predictable, I think, is part of what Ms. Harris was kind of mentioning, around a predictable amount you put in, so then when you need it, it's there.
I'll maybe just know, given the cost to society of infant care, I mean, that's really, I think to a certain extent, it ends up being the preschool kids who are more subsidizing infant care. We've kind of heard that in the presentations. And so just the more weeks the parents are with their children, that just makes the economics of everything work out better, would have seemed to me. Representative Bennett, we'll go to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. So I just have a question about the cost per employee and for the business and the employee. One of our earlier testifiers mentioned that it would be about $3 a week for the employee and for the business. And I just did a little simple math, and roughly that would bring in about $300 a year per employee. And I'm just thinking, how can that ever cover this program? And I understand that some people will never use the program and will be paying into it, but I believe a lot of people probably would, if they're paying into it, they're going to want to use it. So how, that doesn't make sense to me. Am I doing my math wrong? Can somebody maybe enlighten me a little bit on the cost? I know there's an adjustment in the bill language that in 2025, the payroll tax can be adjusted, and I fear that there's going to be an awfully large adjustment made then when we find out we don't have enough money to run the program.
Let's go to Representative Richardson.
Chair Pinto, I'll just start briefly, and we'll also give Ms. Fitzpatrick an opportunity to respond as well. But what we're really talking about is spreading the risk across the state, like we do in many insurance programs. And I think what is really important and some lessons that have been learned from other states that have done this this work, beginning to collect premiums and then delaying the onset of paying benefits has been very helpful in creating sustainable programs within other states. And I think the benefit that we have as a state is we are able to look to how this has played out in eight other states, and we can also look at how it's played out in other countries as well. And we have seen systems that were began before the COVID pandemic continue to be sustainable within the pandemic as well. And so I will turn it over to Ms. Fitzpatrick in case she has anything to add.
Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Yeah, I know we'll be talking a lot about cost modeling when we get to the finance committee, so I don't want to spend a lot of energy here, but I will say that the cost modeling that we've done is the same cost modeling that, as Representative Richardson mentioned, has been used in multiple states. Washington State's the most recent state that has come online. They've been paying ballot benefits for the last year and did so in the middle of COVID. And their payroll contribution is 0.4, ours is 0.6. They are going into that second year being able to maintain at that 0.4 rate. Again, I think the math works because only around, you know, a certain percentage of the population is taking one of these leaves, accessing benefits in a given year. As Representative Richardson mentioned, we are kind of all contributing so that when people really need this support, it's there for them.
Representative Bennett, follow
Thank
up on
you.
That.
Mr. Chair, just another quick question that's similar in line here. So the other issue I wonder about is in factoring in the costs of this and make sure we have reality here with what we're dealing with. What would be the costs for a childcare business when that employee goes on leave? Obviously, they have to replace that employee with some kind of a substitute, which, number one, there really aren't any. Just like in teaching, there's hardly any substitutes available. Childcare, I'm guessing, would probably even be more difficult. And then the paying of that substitute's wage or salary, there's an additional cost there. Has that been factored in or figured out on what that cost might be?
Representative Richardson.
So I would just say right now, when people are out on leave, companies and organizations already have costs right now. And what this, what this bill really is doing in terms of being able to have this benefit model, it is something that is setting up something that is going to be actually much more affordable for smaller businesses, and in many ways, it's going to level their playing field and being able to compete with larger businesses as well. Because typically, what we tend to see is that larger businesses it'll be easier for them to have leave programs than smaller businesses. And so this will be an opportunity to really, again, with that shared cost model, create a pathway to something that is going to be much more affordable than the cost that they're seeing right now. I don't know if Ms. Fitzpatrick has a comment that she'd like to make as well.
I ask you to keep it really brief if you can.
Really brief. I just wanted to build on what Representative Richardson said, to say that we also have, not only are the employers then freed up from paying a worker while they're on leave if they want to keep that worker in their employ, and many do want to keep high quality employees. So they do try to pay to help support that worker when they're on leave. But we also have a grant program in the bill for small employers that they can apply to the state to get some additional assistance to hire, to pay for overtime or to pay for a temporary worker. I know that can be challenging, but there are some, that opportunity is also in the bill. So I just wanted to call that out.
Thank you. And I had warned the folks for our second bill on the agenda that our discussion on this bill might become extended. And so I'm just going to ask you all to continue to be patient and ask folks on this bill. We'll try to keep things as tight as we can. We'll at least try to at least start that second bill if we can. But I want to turn to the Minority Leader Representative Franson.
Good morning, everyone. I was just Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just kind of piggybacking off as well, because there is no cap, there's no ceiling on the floor on premium rates. So while it's great to say, hey, everybody can afford this, who is this committee and the testifiers to determine what people can and cannot afford right now? I have a real problem with that. What's affordable to you is not necessarily affordable to the next person. We've had many of those conversations here at the legislature, what people can afford and what they can't afford. So the fact that there is no ceiling or floor on premium rates is extremely concerning. Another legislature could come in and raise those rates. And right now, as you know, there's many businesses that are barely struggling to keep their doors open. And with the fact that the grants and the loans from the PPE is taxable in Minnesota, that's another punch to the gut to these business owners. And then to add possibly another program tax on top of what they're currently paying or will be paying, something that we just really need to think about. I think that the bill is, I mean, the idea is, I appreciate the idea. I just think realistically, we have to think realistically in today's economy, how are taxpayers, business owners going to be able to afford such a program? It's not really a question, Mr. Chair, just more like random thoughts by Mary Franson.
I was taking it as a comment, and we're going to get to Representative Richardson at the end for your final comment, Representative Richardson. I want to keep things moving. I do want to make sure to note, I believe it's the case that child care centers cannot accept infants before 6 weeks anyway under the rules, and family child care can't accept more than one infant. So and so in practice, families are patchworking it. So just in terms of that part of things, to recognize that. But Representative Franson, you had a follow-up.
Yeah, so depending on the license, family child care providers can take two infants and one toddler, right, or one toddler, or two toddlers and one infant.
Thank you. Good point. So we're going to final person from the committee here is Representative Wasilewicz. Representative Wasilewicz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've had a really good discussion today, and over the past several weeks, we've talked about all of the importance of why investing in the early years is really important and why having parents be part of that is really important. I think one thing that I wanted to bring folks back to was one of the presenters several weeks ago had a slide that showed sort of what young families, what their position is when they have their first kids economically. And if folks remember from that slide, it's sort of the years when families are usually earning the least amount of money. And so asking families to then say, one of you has to, you know, not get paid to be able to take care of a child, I think it's a really difficult decision for a lot of families to make. As a person who works in childcare, I've been around families who have had those discussions, coworkers who have had those discussions about whether they're going to continue to work. And these are some of my coworkers, right, who are working in childcare. And to points that other folks have made, it's hard to find qualified employees who work in childcare. And so having some of my coworkers saying, well, I don't know if it's worth it to stay in this job when I just had a baby and I have to take care of that baby. And I think there's a lot of questions around those decisions. And I think this makes it easier for families to make a decision about what they're going to do and providing that support for them in those early years when they're not doing as well economically and they're able to take paid leave and continue to build on that economic security that gets, you know, that improves as their children get older, I think is a really important piece of this puzzle. And just wanted to point that out as a reminder to folks that's sort of where families are at and the decisions that are being made. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Wasilewicz. And before I turn to Representative Richardson, I just want to note that it seems like Democrat, Republican, Greater Minnesota, Metro, Suburban, like we all agree that parents should be with their kids in those critical early weeks. I feel like I just hear that, I pick that up. It's just critical. And it seems like there's probably nothing more critical as a society. In fact, we want especially low income, but all children, right? All new babies should be with their families and with their parents in those critical early weeks. And we should do everything that we can. And really, I'm grateful to you, Representative Richardson, for advancing this to make sure that happens on behalf of all of us. So I'll turn to you for final comments before the vote.
Thank you, Chair Pinto. And just one thing that I wanted to highlight before getting to my final comments, the question from Vice Chair Pryor around returning to work in 2 weeks, you know, according to the Department of Labor, it's 25% of families are, you know, being faced with that of having to return within that 2 week period. And I think, Chair Pinto, what you really said is really key. The key to this bill is the fact that it is universal. We don't have sort of two systems of where some people have access to really be able to create an environment and an opportunity for their infant to be healthy and thrive. This is about ensuring that all working families, regardless of where they live, how much money that they make, that they have that opportunity that we all agree that they deserve an opportunity to be with their child during those critical bonding period times, to be able to set up their child for the best possible health, and so that we're moving past the survival mentality to really being able to have families thrive. So thank you for the opportunity to present the bill today, and I ask for support.
Thank you, Representative Richardson, and all your testifiers. So with that, Representative Pryor renews her motion that House File 1200 be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. And Ms. Chambers, if you can please take the roll.
Representative Pinto, Chair.
Aye.
Representative Pryor, Vice Chair.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
No.
Representative Bennett.
No.
Representative Bolden?
Aye.
Representative Daniels?
No.
Representative Dabney?
Aye.
Representative Damon?
No.
Representative Jurgens?
No.
Representative Cotiza Watoon?
Aye.
Representative Morrison?
Morrison, aye.
Representative Wasilewicz?
Aye.
Representative Wolgamott?
Aye.
We have 9 ayes and 4 nays.
Thank you, Ms. Chambers. And with that, the motion passes and prevails, pardon me, and House File 1200 is referred to State Government Finance. Congratulations and thank you, Representative Richardson. And again, thank you to your amazing slate of testifiers. We really appreciate it. I want to apologize to Representative Howard. We're going to make it through as much of your bill as we can. Representative Pryor, I'll ask you to move that House File 316 be placed before the committee.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Howard, if you can please begin the presentation of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and no apology necessary. I don't serve on a committee that's going to, I think, hear the previous bill, so I was glad to, it felt like extra. So anyways, thank you, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair and committee. I'm here to present a bill that I presented to this committee about a year ago to the day to provide a grant program to support our family, friend, and neighbor child care providers. And if only we would have known a year ago just how important our FFN child care providers would be in the midst of this pandemic. It's really underscored the necessity of support for our FFN child care providers. And for members that aren't familiar with the term, family, friend, and neighbor child care providers offer legal unlicensed child care to thousands of families across the state. They're frequently the choice of care for parents with infants and toddlers, parents in diverse culture and ethnic communities, parents in more rural communities, and those who work non-standard hour jobs. The high cost of child care and shortage of child care slots means more families are turning to FFNs for care. And just to give you a few statistics, nearly 40% of children aged 2 and younger are cared for in these settings, 25% of children aged 3 to 5, and overall, over 200,000 children in total across Minnesota. So this is a significant section of children receiving care in FFN networks. And in particular, as I mentioned, BIPOC families, immigrant and refugee families, families in rural Minnesota often are cared for in FFN networks. This bill would create a grant program to provide support and resources for our FFN networks to promote social emotional learning and health development, early literacy with a focus on school readiness, and foster community partnerships, and so that these networks have the tools they need to provide care to our youngest. And there are effective low-cost models for FFN support that have been functioning for several years, and we'll hear about that with some of our testimony. And at the state level, we really have an important opportunity, a necessity, I would argue, to support these networks, to expand, to strengthen them, because without doing so, I really think we're kind of doomed to see some of our inequities in our child care system persist. This is a critical way that we at the state level can step up to support child care providers that are stepping up in so many ways for all young people in Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair, I would turn it over to my testifiers. I believe Fabiola is our first testifier.
Yeah, and I just want testifiers to know we have got to end strictly at 10 a.m., and so we're going to move as quickly as we can. I want to note for members the connection between the two bills we're hearing today, and that many parents, new parents, are going to be using these methods of care for their kids in those critical first couple weeks of having the sometimes it's going to be a neighbor or a friend. And so, as I say, testifiers, you can keep yourself really, really short if you can. My apologies. So first, Fabiola Martinez de Estrada, and if you can identify yourself for the record, unmute yourself and proceed.
Good morning. Mr. Chair and the members of the committee, my name is Fabiola Martinez de Estrada, and I am a co-founder of La Red Latina de Educación Temprana, which means the Network of Early Childhood Education in Spanish. La Red is a group of Latinos leaders making health change that benefit children and members of Latino community living in Richfield, Bloomington, and across Minnesota. Established in 2013, La Red develops community-driven solutions to support healthy child development and early learning opportunities for children whose family shows and or need for care family members, friends, and neighbors. We do this by providing culturally relevant early childhood trainings, capacity, and learning development for Latino child care providers who deliver the quality highs possible and support school readiness. I want to express my gratitude for the family and friends and neighbors provide grant programs, build house and file 316, the activities that we found through this grant program. We are the same activities that we know work for the families of the FFN providers in our network. I'm proud to represent our family, friends and neighbors network and happy to respond any questions you might have for FFN. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Ruth Evangelista, you are next. Please unmute yourself and identify yourself. And again, if you can keep it real quick.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Ruth Evangelista, and I'm also a co-founder of La Red. Families across the state are using and choosing family, friends, and neighbors to care and provide learning opportunities for their children. Some because they want a caregiver who shares the cultural background, and other because there is a shortage of childcare across the state. We know 40% of Minnesota's infant and toddlers and 25% of preschoolers are cared for by family, friends, and neighbors provider. Yet, there is very little support for family, friends, and neighbors provider. Our members have to figure out how to provide safe care during the COVID-19 pandemic with no state or federal support. And based on data from the Home Grow Fund, almost half of FFN providers closed during the pandemic. It has been an ongoing challenge for FFM providers to have access to the supplies and materials, including cleaning supplies, hand sanitizers, masks, and nutrition food needed to continue to operate and provide safe and high-quality childcare. The providers in our network are doing the best they can with no resources and very limited support. We support House File 316 and hope this grant program will begin to change the discussion to ensuring every Minnesotan child has access to high quality care and learning experience, regardless of who is providing their care. We have been connected with the community of Workington and Rochester, expressing interest in starting an FFN network, but funding is essential to give these communities the resources necessary to begin. Thank you, and I'm happy to respond to any additional questions you have.
Thank you so much. Ms. Bofer, you are up if you can unmute yourself and identify yourself. There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Joan Bofer. I'm a health promotion specialist with the City of Bloomington Public Health Division. As a public health professional, I'm keenly aware that childhood development is an important determinant of health over a person's lifetime. Early development opportunities can provide a foundation for children's academic success, health, and general well-being. And studies show that quality childcare and education can play a key role in reducing risky health behaviors and preventing or delaying the onset of chronic diseases in adulthood, such as obesity, heart disease, and diabetes. I have partnered with our local family, friend, and neighbor childcare provider network, LARED, since its beginning in 2013. In late 2012, Latino leaders in Bloomington and Richfield brought to Bloomington Public Health their concerns that many of their FFN child care providers did not have familiarity with the school system to adequately prepare their children for kindergarten or the knowledge and training to foster health and development. In partnership with these leaders, we began a project to bring child care training to a small group of FFN providers. This small project grew into an incredibly successful network that has reached more than 250 Latino FFNs. The role that public health played in this success was as an institutional partner that was able to connect our local FFN providers with training and to other agencies that could collaborate in providing support to the network. I was
Ms. Bofer, I'll ask if you can wrap up in just the next few seconds if you can. We got 3 minutes and a bunch of things we got to get done. So if you can.
Okay. Well, I'm excited about this particular grant program because community-based FFN networks really need the support of partners like local public health who know the local resources and can bring them to the FFN providers. This is important because as a community-based solution to the childcare issue, FFN networks can really be helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And Ms. Corrado, you're our last testifier. And again, if you could keep things real quick. There you go.
Yes, I'll be super quick. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Allison Corrado. I'm a senior program officer with the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota Foundation and the co-chair of the Public Policy Committee of the Start Early Funders Coalition. Supporting FFM providers is a top priority for the Start Early Funders Coalition in 2021. And we are just so excited to see House File 316 being discussed. We know that FFM providers are so often left out of the conversation when we're talking about how to support childcare providers. And they are so critical, as you've heard in the testimony before. So with that, I will pass to the next person.
Thank you so much, Ms. Corrado. And as you say, this is an area that really is overlooked. And so I'm so glad to be hearing about it now. There was one more testifier, Debbie Ziesmer, who will send in her written testimony. She had signed up after the deadline. I'd hope we could fit her in, but she's going to send in written testimony. Are there questions or discussion members to confirm this will be laid over? We will not be voting on it today, so we'll have more of a chance to talk at a later date. But I'm just looking to see. Representative Pryor, just something quick.
Just want to say real quick, what a great bill. As a family, friend, and neighbor provider for All 7 grandchildren. This is so very much needed and really good work. And thank you all the testifiers for being here today. You really are making a big impact. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pryor. And I will note, and perhaps Representative Howard, you know this, you could note this in your final remarks, but I think a very huge, we do spend a lot of time on child care centers and family child care, and of course we do, but a very significant percentage of young kids are being cared for in these sorts of settings. And it's so important, as Ms. Corrado pointed to, that that not be overlooked. Representative Howard, I'm not seeing any other hands up, and so I'm going to ask you to please provide any final comments that you have on your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and would love to follow up offline with any members if you want to talk further. As folks have said, this is just so huge, and it's really kind of a missing blind spot, if you will, in terms of state policy and how we support these important FFN networks. Hundreds of thousands of kids all across the state receive care in this way, and we should try to support our FFN providers. So with that, thank you for the time, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Howard. It really is an important bill, and I'm looking forward to continuing to talk about it. And I do want to thank all the testifiers. My apologies that things were so quick, but we really appreciate it, and we'll continue having those conversations. With that, I will lay over House File 316 for possible inclusion in a budget bill at a later date. There is one important bit of committee business, members, which is that we had an error in the announcement of the vote total from the last House File 1200. So, Ms. Chambers, if you can just please provide that information to us.
Yes, Chair Pinto. We had 8 yays and 5 nays.
Okay. And that was on House File 1200, Ms. Chambers?
Yes.
Okay. Good. Thank you so much. So we've had that correction. Members, we have a very action-packed day on Thursday as well. I think we have 6 bills up, so bring your A game. Be ready to be there. And with that, our meeting is adjourned. Thanks very much. Have a great day, everybody.